Okay, we'll bring together the, to order the Public Safety Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee and start out with the roll call.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Considine.
Here.
Representative Dean. Representative Flanagan. Representative Hertas. Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Howe.
Here.
Representative Lohmer.
Here.
Representative Lucero.
Here.
Representative Neuberger.
Ready, sir.
Representative O'Neill. Representative Quam.
Present.
Representative Rosenthal. Representative Schoen.
Yeah, here.
Representative Ward. Representative Zerwas.
Okay, I entertain a motion to approve the minutes for March 31st. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll move the minutes.
Representative Howe moves the minutes for March 31st. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, members, and we've got 9 bills to get through today, so we'd appreciate it if we just move through them quickly as possible and efficiently, of course. And if we don't, we'll probably have to come back here this evening due with all the deadlines we're facing and the bills numbers. So we'll start off with House File 3385, Representative Heisman. Representative Heisman, I will move House File 3385 and refer to the General Register. Go ahead, however you wish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'll allow my testifier to introduce herself and discuss the bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Sue Vanek. I live in Nisswa, Minnesota, a resident of Crow Wing County. I'm here today to just kind of point out the reasons why our bill came to be and the reasons behind that. January 15th, 2015, our 24-year-old daughter and 4-year-old grandchild were severely injured when they had been hit head-on by an unlicensed driver. Our daughter suffered a global brain injury, skull fractures, dissected carotid artery, stroke, fractures of her nose, sternum, humerus, ulna, ribs, femur, and currently resides in a nursing home in a persistent vegetative state. Our grandchild also suffered a lot of injuries. She had a brain injury, spinal injury of her neck, liver laceration, ball perforations, blood clot in her heart, severe humerus fracture with nerves damage that took 25 surgeries and 99 days in intensive care to heal her up. Our son-in-law in this situation now is struggling to make ends meet on a single income. He has to pay $9,000 a month out of his pocket to keep his wife in the nursing home because their insurance doesn't cover it. Once the insurance award money is gone, this once thriving two-income family is going to be forced to live on government-funded programs and assistance to make it meet. The reckless unlicensed driver in our situation had non-life-threatening injuries, received his 8th misdemeanor charge for driving after suspension, paid $435 in fines and fees, sat 30 days in jail, was ordered to complete 240 hours of community service and placed on a year probation. There was an order for restitution of over $4,000, and we've only received a couple hundred dollars of that since our court in September of 2015. Hoping our tragic example can truly emphasize the need for stronger penalties to more effectively deal with chronic, reckless offenders of driving without our license. Since the accident, I've had many, many conversations, some of them quite heated, with different branches of law enforcement, lawyers, city and county attorneys, asking how in the world it was possible that there was no higher charge to put on the offender in our accident. Their answers were all the same, that there was nothing more they can do. Current law only allows the reckless chronic offender to be charged with a misdemeanor. And these same individuals have encouraged me to move forward with legislation, encouraging me to pursue action that would include enhanced sentencing and escalated fines, and have offered to help me out however possible. Our offender, to give you a little history on his driving, from August 2003 to December 2014, he had 23 driving-related charges. 7 of those charges were for driving after revocation or suspension. 3 of those 7 occurred within the previous 4 months, and 2 occurred in 1 day. What stood out on his record was a gross misdemeanor. The offender was received a gross misdemeanor charge for using artificial light to locate an animal. I was furious to learn that the penalty for hunting with an artificial light carried a higher charge than what happened in our situation and almost killing our girls' lives driving without a license. Apparently, driving unlicensed and causing an individual to be in a persistent vegetative coma isn't serious enough to warrant a higher charge unless you are under the influence of drugs and alcohol, which didn't apply. I was very confused and concerned that a licensed drunk driver is charged so drastically different than a reckless unlicensed driver when in both instances it's drivers that are on the road illegally and the consequences to their victims are the same. Every time I've posed that question, they say our hands are tied, it's how the law is written. The judge in our case was extremely verbal and strong in his feelings about this. He told the offender that he is lucky the law doesn't allow for stricter penalties for the crime. He stated that he was not impressed with the driving record, as appears he makes it a routine to violate traffic laws, and that this accident was bound to happen. He then went on to say that he has to go by what law states today on the penalties for traffic violations, and he was very frustrated. As lawmakers, there have been very specific criteria created considering an individual's age, amount of training, education, and testing for an individual to have the privilege of obtaining a driver's licenses. The licenses are drivers are held accountable to follow specific steps to ensure they retain the privilege. When someone doesn't comply, law dictates that revoking or suspending is the privilege that's a consequence that's appropriate. Laws also revoke or suspend licenses penalties for other things as failure to pay child support, driving under the influence, or not having insurance on your vehicle. This to me is an indicator of how important you view the necessity of holding a valid driver's license. But unfortunately, in my opinion, lawmakers have taken a really soft stance when it comes to charging and creating penalties for those that continue to break this law. Offenders currently are going to receive the same charge and fine no matter how many times they are caught driving unlicensed. And because the consequences are so low, people are simply taking the risk of driving unlicensed, knowing that if they are caught, the punishment is only a misdemeanor. Current law also doesn't consider harming or killing someone in the act of driving unlicensed anything more than a misdemeanor unless there's drugs or alcohol involved. Our hope is that with enhanced sentencing and escalated fines, you can reinforce that driving without a valid license is a serious crime. We are very aware that there are groups telling you that this is going to negatively impact certain individuals and further perpetuate poverty onto those with low incomes. Don't let these voices complicate a simple solution to address a very, very serious problem. There are thousands of unlicensed drivers on our road every day. Many of these unlicensed drivers are cautious when they drive, and they may never encounter law enforcement, even though they are illegally on the road. You then have the others that without a license still choose to drive. They're speeding, they're reckless, and they are at a higher risk of getting into an accident and harming innocent victims. It is these drivers that we are hoping to impact in our bill. We're not going to be creating more unlicensed drivers, but we are going to be imposing harsher consequences and fines on those that do choose to chronically offend.
Thank you very much for your testimony, ma'am. And any other testifiers, Representative Heisman? Any questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Heitzman as well as the testifier. So I know that Ramsey County does some programs for those individuals that have had trouble with license suspension and other types of issues. Is that something we could move statewide instead of just looking at something that's a little more punitive, which ultimately probably isn't going to remove these individuals from driving? Ultimately, it's just going to impose larger penalties on them. And if the goal is to either remove them from driving or to get them to the point that they've paid their fines and they've gotten their license reinstated, how is this bill really going to address what I think we all want, which is safer roads, people that have valid driver's license? And I would say that that also includes the one license for folks in Minnesota who actually are here as undocumented individuals that can't get a license. And if we pass that, that would also make our roads safer. So I guess my question quickly is, how is this setting it up so that individuals can get back on track and not continue to struggle with fines and things like that that are prohibiting them from getting their license reinstated?
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I think that what this bill seeks to do is sometimes now considered an old-fashioned idea. there needs to be penalties when people are breaking the law or potentially hurting another Minnesotan. And the idea is deterrence.
Any other testifiers?
I follow.
Oh, Representative Veen, go ahead.
Okay, I appreciate this old-fashioned idea, but old-fashioned ideas really haven't moved the bar on where we're going with these issues. And if these individuals are in situations where they need to get to jobs so that they can pay their child support or other types of things, you're actually exacerbating the difficulties that these individuals are having. And you speak of penalties, but you know, it's one thing to want to punish people. It's another thing to want to redirect their lives in a different way. And if all we're going to do is punishing people, we need to be careful about the laws we create, because one of the laws we create may affect you and your life. And that means that you could be guilty of a crime, even though you're just trying to live your life. So when we talk about penalties, we're talking about crimes that we've all created within society. And I think that's completely the wrong way to go. Thank you.
Representative Considine, and then Representative Huang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, my condolences. I lost my brother a little over a year ago when a guy blew through a stop sign and killed him and charged with a misdemeanor. At some point, though, there is justice. And to see people just walk away with a misdemeanor is infuriating. And if somebody is chronic as the guy you're describing, there's not going to be any deterrence. There's not going to be any fix. He's just going to keep doing it. And all it really does is get him off the streets a little longer. So, thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and ma'am. I'm so sorry. And it's a tragedy. But the other tragedy is this is not a single incident. And obviously there is no punishment that these people seem to think they're getting, and hopefully there'll be sufficient additional correction so that they maybe will actually do something about it, because frankly it's up to them to go through the efforts and get their license back, because there was a reason they lost it in the first place, and allowing them to continue a tragedy is no excuse. And frankly, I'm ashamed that anyone would object to trying to stop this horrid thing that continues to happen in our state.
Okay, I thought that would elicit a response. So, Representative Dean.
Well, first off, let me preface this that I lost a good friend yesterday on 94. So, I think it's important that we make our roads as safe as possible. And that's my goal. This isn't about looking at the tragedy that happens on our roads every day and trying to address how best to make them as safe as possible. So this isn't about letting people off. This isn't about going easy. This is really about how do we make our roads safer. And ultimately, that's why I have some issues with this moving forward. I'm sorry for the loss. Losses are always tragic. And you're absolutely right, Representative Quam. There are individuals out there that don't learn. And I would say for some of those, we need to seriously consider penalties. But there are also a large group of people out there that do learn. And we need to create the opportunity for them to redirect their lives and change their pathway. So I'm just going to close with that comment. And we'll vote on the bill, I guess.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This isn't going to be a deterrent. Morons like this guy aren't smart enough to have deterrence. This is about justice, and that's the only thing I wanted to say is I don't want to get anybody's hopes up that we're actually going to deter these people, because it just isn't going to happen. Thank you.
Okay, no more testifiers. Any opposition? Representative Hillstrom, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually just want to get to actually some of the language. I was talking with nonpartisan staff here, and if we could just get some clarification. So this bill creates a gross misdemeanor violation And these are all ands. So if the person's license is canceled or denied under Minnesota Statute 171.04, Subdivision 1, Clause 10, which is the inimical to public safety. So that means you've had your license taken for multiple DWIs. This isn't if you had your license taken for failure to pay child support. You have to have been given notice that your license is canceled, and you have to disobey the order saying that you can't operate, so you're operating it. But the question then gets to, the person is guilty of a gross misdemeanor if they're involved in the collision. So that means even if they weren't the driver that caused the accident, if they were, so if I'm driving and I don't have a license, and someone behind me hits me of no fault of my own, but someone in that car dies, then I, the driver of the vehicle who didn't cause the accident, would be convicted of a gross misdemeanor. Is that the way you read this language? And if you don't know, we can ask nonpartisan staff.
I'd refer that to staff.
Was there any opposition to the... Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Hillstrom is pointing to the language on line 2.25 and 2.26, and it does say involved in a collision. So I think her scenario would be correct. We could change that by an amendment if that's the will of the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that was my question. So is it your intent that if you're just involved in the crash, whether or not you're at fault for the crash, that you should have the gross misdemeanor offense, or is it that you are the one that caused the crash that causes you to want a gross misdemeanor conviction?
Okay. Representative Heisman.
I think that the intent was not to involve that particular individual with the enhanced penalties.
Can she fix it?
Go ahead. Representative Ms. Perez.
Mr. Chair and members, so this would be an amendment to line 2.26. Delete is involved in a collision and insert causes an accident. So the sentence would now read, a person is guilty of gross misdemeanor if the person violates this section and causes an accident resulting in substantial bodily harm or death to another.
I'm kind of wondering if we use the term accident anymore, collision or crash.
Crash.
Mm-hmm. Crash, yeah. Would that work?
Yes.
That's okay with the amendment author? Okay. Now, staff, you've got that. Representative Heisman, do you approve of the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I actually have a question. Representative
Hillstrom,
how would that play out in a percentage of negligence?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the question always is to what level a degree of responsibility the person has for the crash in determining criminal responsibility. And so a prosecutor will always be looking at that. Misdemeanors are done through tickets, but gross misdemeanors are done through complaints. So you'll have a city attorney who will be reviewing the facts to determine whether or not the person's met the standard of these other items. I just really wanted to get at if it was your intent to have someone who was not responsible for the crash, but maybe just in the wrong place at the wrong time without a license, should be charged.
Representative Heisman.
I think I could consider the amendment friendly.
Okay, members, you've heard the amendment offered by Representative Hillstrom. If everybody stands it and there's no more questions, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay, now, Representative Schoen.
Mr. Chair, and this is to you and staff. I know Representative Considine and Representative Groffel worked on a bill last year related to gross negligence causing crashes. And have you looked at this in particular? I mean, this incident may have happened before we passed the legislation. What I'm curious about is, are we overlapping some things here that may have rectified what this bill is going to do? This one, now that I'm thinking about it, and maybe you've looked and it's not.
I was wondering if you're talking about the failure to yield one or something that Groff, everybody
was
had
it
about.
Just that? Was it just related to that? I kind of forgot.
Just curious, do you know what he's meant?
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, the bill you're referencing that passed last year was under reckless driving, and so it states a person who is guilty of reckless driving and causes great bodily harm or death to another is guilty of a gross misdemeanor.
Enough said. Thank you.
All right. Is there anybody from the audience that wanted to testify? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion that House File 3385 be, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Thank you, Representative. And thank you, ma'am,
thank
for your
testimony. Thank you very
much. Good job. Representative Swedinski. Swedinski, is this a bill that we have heard and passed from the House before, and now that the Senate has passed a version and you've got a DE to address the changes?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, then the chair will move House File 71 to be referred to the General Register, and the chair will also move the DE-1 amendment to get it in the shape the author would like it. With no objection, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, Representative Swedinski, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. What I'll do, since this bill has been in before the committee, I'll kind of just run by a couple of the changes. We were thankful that the Senator Latz moved upon the bill. We had this bill in our omnibus bill, but obviously it was stripped out in the during conference committee. So the difference between House File 71 and the DE-1 amendment primarily revolves around the qualifying prior driving offense. So if you look at the old bill, it would be like 1.12, and that moves through. The intention of that portion of the bill was to, if during a previous DWI there were other factors, so there were bodily harm or destruction of property during a previous DWI, that we would look at those, we would ask the judge to look at those as opportunities to increase the penalty, with the idea that during those circumstances, someone would realize that their drunkenness while driving can cause bodily harm and damage to property. And so this bill, that portion does move out. What this does is open up the door a little bit, and primarily on the second page of the DE, or the it really just moves, current law allows for a maximum penalty up to 10 years, and this would move it to 15. And with that, I have Brad Bigler. This House File 71 is called Drake's Law, and that's named after a young feller that was killed by a repeat drunk driver, and I have Brad Bigler here to speak on behalf of the bill. So thank you.
Okay. Sir, go ahead with your name.
Brad Bigler. And I just want to again say thank you. This is the second time we were able to come in front of you. I apologize. My wife wanted to be here, but she's a social worker in the school district, and she had to be there today. She could not miss. So anytime laws like this come up, a lot of times there's a tragic accident that's happened that pushes the envelope and makes you reevaluate the laws. And in this situation, we were unfortunate to have lost a five-month-old son. And this is, in going through the process of the courts, and this is a situation, this drunken driver was four times over the limit, was a third time DWI, was someone who, honestly, didn't respect your life, my life, or even his life in making this decision. And with that said, this law is very specific. This law now is getting right to the point, and that's holding those people accountable who have made a consistent poor decisions and putting themselves in a situation where this isn't just a routine stop. When we're talking with the Senate, there was discussion, well, if this is the third time, I just kind of make this bad, one bad decision. Well, it's more than just a routine stop. This is something where you have just killed somebody with your car, with a bad decision, with a drinking and driving of normally of a higher level. And the severity of this is really, again, we're trying to narrow in very specific on that individual who doesn't care. And that individual who, again, to allow the judge upward departure and to hold them a little bit more accountable, to give them the flexibility. In our sentence, again, there was only so much the judge could do, and the lawyers as well, and it was pretty much set in stone what was going to happen. He didn't have enough criminal points. He didn't have felony points to be able to put that upper departure. And so, again, this bill, when you look at states surrounding us, sometimes, again, you go through the process and you reevaluate where we're at. I don't know if you're aware, but in the seven states around us, with us, Wisconsin, Illinois, Iowa, Nebraska, South Dakota, North Dakota, Minnesota ranks last. And not only do they rank last, but they rank last by quite a bit. In this exact same situation, in Wisconsin, it's 40 years. That's your maximum sentence. Nebraska, it's 50 years. North Dakota, it's life. Illinois, it's 28 years. Iowa is 25 years. And South Dakota is 15. For us here in Minnesota, we currently have it at 10. So when you hear those numbers, it kind of is another example, well, maybe this law has kind of played its course, and now it's time to reevaluate it. And to get it to bump it to 15 is just a step in the right direction. And it may be, who knows, maybe in time we need to reevaluate again to bump it up. But right now, 15 is just a small step to improve awareness and to hold those accountable for those actions who have, again, repeated offenders in drinking and driving incidents. And in someone who has taken a life. Is there anything else you would like to ask?
Looks like not. Thank you very much, sir, for your testimony. Representative, any questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question is really for Representative Swedzinski. Since it's adding 5 years to a 10-year sentence, I'm assuming that we don't see a fiscal note because that impact really won't take place until 2027?
It would be down the road. That's why it shows a zero. Yeah.
Okay. And then a quick follow-up. Do you know how many incidences similar to this that happen? Is it the magnitude? Is it 2 a year? Is it 20 a year? I guess I'm just curious. It looks like he knows.
Mr. Chair, do you want to?
I thought the Senate might have said 5, but I could be wrong on that. You might want to check that. But I thought that they said 5 potentially.
Okay. So if I do the math, the aggregate in 2027 over 10 years at 5 a year is going to be in excess of over 50 beds starting right away and probably increasing accordingly. So I'm just trying to think long-term what this does to some of our issues around our prison population.
I think you also tried to apologize. Mr. Chair, I apologize.
You understand the question?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Brief answer.
Yeah, I can, I think when you're looking at that, we're not doing a statutory, maximum. We're not requiring that. We're asking the judge to potentially use that as give them a little more brevity. So,
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm looking at the amendment, and I just want to make it clear and ask if that's your intention. So it's your intention to only include incidences where someone was under the influence of drugs or alcohol. I see that you don't have number one, on page two, line 2.25 to line 2.27, it says under paragraph A, clause 2 through 6, which leaves off in a gross negligent manner, and that is your intention to only do folks who are under the influence. Is that correct?
Representative Sudinski.
Mr. Chair, yes, I believe so.
Okay. No other questions? Any other testifiers? Okay, if not, the chair will renew his motion. House File 71 be referred to the General Register as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, thank you, Representative. Thank you for your testimony, sir. Representative Hackbarth has House File 2845. Members, this comes to us as a game and fish bill, basically, but it came here because of penalties, so we'll address the penalty section. Representative Hackbarth, I'll move your bill, House File 2845, to be referred to the General Register and offer the DE2 amendment to get it in the shape that the author would like it. With no questions, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This is a gross over-limits bill. It came from the Department of Natural Resources. I'm carrying it as chief author. I amended it quite a bit in the Mining and Outdoor Recreation Committee. And, Mr. Chairman, you asked us to come to a peace in the valley on this issue. We had some trappers and some hunters and some other folks and the DNR all working on this to create that peace in the valley, and this amendment does that. So I think we're all in agreement now, and we can move forward.
Did you want to give a brief explanation of the bill, or?
I can have the DNR do it, or I also have some other folks that would like to speak to the bill, but we want to be very, very brief and respectful of your time. I know you have a lot to get through today.
Why don't you call the witnesses as you'd like? I'll leave it up to you.
Okay. Well, maybe you want to go ahead.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Rodman Smith, Director of Enforcement, Department of Natural Resources, and I'll quickly walk through the bill, Mr. Chair, if that's okay.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Sections 1 and 2 deal with the prosecutory authority of not just game and fish law, but for lack of a better term, all DNR law. So current language in line 1.5 says that the county attorneys must prosecute all game and fish laws. That we want to make sure that that's expanded to include all of the laws that DNR enforces, so like wetlands law 103G and some invasive species law. So as you can see in line 1.9 to 1.12 or 1.9 to 1.10, the county attorneys are primary prosecutory authority for, and when 97A205, that describes the enforcement powers for conservation officers related to environmental law. And then line 1.1 to 1.2 just clarifies that the prosecutor does have the authority for civil forfeiture actions that are associated with violations of game and fish law. So this isn't giving county attorneys, or this isn't increasing any forfeiture activities. It's just clarifying in law that the county attorneys can work through that civil process. It would be similar to a DWI when somebody is prosecuted criminally with DWI and then there's some type of civil action against the vehicle. So that's just clarifying that in law. Line 1.21 to line 1.22, it's just somebody clarifying that somebody making a false statement in an affidavit regarding a violation or requirement of the game and fish law. So it's just part of that affidavit process that it's a violation or a requirement. So that could be a permit or whatnot. And then, Mr. Chair, the rest of the bill is dealing with the gross over limits and the gross over limit provisions. So when this was originally introduced, there was a felony provision, and that felony provision has been removed. So right now, the current language deals with enhanced penalties associated more administratively with the revocation of hunting and fishing licenses. So the over limits are based on restitution value. So if a person, for example, has illegally takes wild animals where the restitution value exceeds $2,000, now they would have a 10-year revocation for their hunting and fishing licenses. And restitution values are authorized in statute for the commissioner to assign those restitution values and rule. And so just about every animal does have a restitution value and rule. So some examples, how could somebody get to $2,000? You'd have to have 67 walleyes over your limit. That's not a mistake. That's not misreading a regulation or miscounting. You'd have to shoot five turkeys or five bear over your limit. That's not a misinterpretation of the rule or simple counting. These are premeditated acts that people are doing. So it's not there's not an enhanced criminal penalty. It's that enhanced civil or administrative penalty where they are not going to be able to hunt or fish for 10 years. And that's the gist of the bill, and I can stand for questions.
Okay. Any questions so far? Representative Schoen first, and then Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the first part, Representative Hackbarth, is basically a technical correction bill. And then the second part, we're dealing with something new. And
gross over limit.
So quickly, without a, if you're bringing somebody up to explain a story, if we could do it without a five-minute dissertation on what that was, if there's a couple quick examples that you can provide that sparked this. I know I've seen some over the years where somebody has a, you know, cube van full of Canadian geese or, you know, decides to, it's pretty willful, there's no question about it, which actually surprises me why we took the felony out of it, because this is not something that is all that, I mean, you don't accidentally do this. And number two, what happens, so you're going to give them a 10-year revocation, which is already in law, I believe, for the license on other issues, or there's a, hunting and license revocation part. But so some of these folks, I mean, they have enough money to just go do it anyway and pay the civil fine if they want to. So what's the stick on this then?
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the questions. So there have been a couple cases that have really shocked the conscience, and Governor Dayton was, this is one of his initiatives that we've been bringing forward. And, you know, I think you may have seen some of them on the news. There was an individual in the Sherbourne National Wild Refuge that took a number of trophy deer. There's been a case out in southwestern Minnesota, and another case where there's a number of trophy deer taking. We've also had a number of fishing incidents where people are literally hundreds of panfish over their limit. So there have been a new, it doesn't happen often, but when it does happen, it's theft. It's, and it's somewhat disgusting for a lot of folks when they see that. So it's one of these, we call it the shock to conscience violation. So as far as the stick, currently in law, it's a 5-year revocation is the maximum. And so, and that's with the $2,000 restitution value. We're dropping the 5-year revocation down to $1,000 restitution value, and then adding a 10-year restitution or a 10-year revocation for anything over $2,000. In law, current law, if you are caught hunting or fishing after you've been revoked, you can be charged with a gross misdemeanor. So there is a little bit of a stick for somebody that continues to hunt or fish after revocation. If you are revoked in Minnesota, Minnesota is part of what's called the Wildlife Violator Compact Act. So Minnesota, along with 46 other states, you would also be revoked from buying a hunting or fishing license in those other 47 states. So there is some stick to this.
Okay, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure if this would be for Representative Hackbarth or for the commission. Commissioner, when I look at the gross overlimit wild animal penalty and I look at Section B that's added, it says if a wild animal involved in a violation under this section is listed as a threatened or endangered wild animal, the penalty in paragraph A does not apply unless more than one animal is taken, possessed, or transported in violation of game and fish laws. So my question to you is, over the past several years, there's been lots of discussion about wolves in the state of Minnesota. If I go out and I shoot a wolf as a trophy, but I don't shoot two of them, I would not be included under the gross over limits. Is that correct?
Colonel. Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. So the reason this language is in here is we do have people that make a mistake, and we've had people in the past most recently in southeastern Minnesota that have shot what they thought was a trophy-sized coyote, and it ended up being a wolf that came in from Minnesota or came in from Wisconsin. And so people do make mistakes, and with the felony level and the 10-year revocation, it seemed like because endangered and threatened species, they do have a $2,000 restitution value on them automatically. Mm-hmm. That would automatically put them into this gross over limit, and we were conscious about making sure that people that do make mistakes wouldn't fall into this gross over limit penalty. And majority of the time, just to clarify, when animals that are threatened or endangered are taken, conservation officers will assist in that investigation, but more often than not, those are turned over to the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service for investigation and prosecution federally.
Representative Dean.
So just a quick follow-up. So is there a time limit period where this would apply? Because if someone makes a mistake 3 years later, the same mistake that they made 3 years ago, would this apply or would this not apply?
Mr. Chair, Representative, under this, you'd have to be part of one course of conduct or a group of course of conduct. So if it was two separate incidents, under the current language, you're 10 years apart, it would not apply.
Yeah, but my question was 2 or 3 years apart, not 10 years apart.
Okay, 2 or 3 years. Mr. Chair, 2 or 3 years. It depends on the course of conduct and how you'd make that case with your county attorney if this was an ongoing issue or not.
Okay. So technically it could be 3 days if you were no longer in possession of the previous accident or mistake.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it depends on the totality of the circumstances, but that could be possible.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilsman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm kind of curious. So the governor had proposed having a felony provision and longer revocation periods. I'm curious as to why you decided to take out the felony provision, because the governor has really talked about this as, this is equal to theft. And I'm looking at the theft statutes, and under financial transaction card fraud, if you steal or attempt to steal $250 from Target or Walmart, it's currently a felony, a 5-year felony. And we're talking about taking animals from the state and the people of Minnesota, and it not ever getting to the point of a felony, even if the value is well over $2,000. So I'm curious as to the reason you chose to take the felony provision out.
Either one. It wasn't.
I think everybody's in agreement that it was better to take the more severe penalty out. I think everybody's on board with that.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you've spoken to the governor's office, and the governor's fine with going with the lesser penalty, or the governor's?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, the department is okay with it. I know that.
Okay. Representative Schoen.
Well, thank you. Well, Representative Hackbarth, is that because you wouldn't carry the bill forward with the felony or no?
No, we, Mr. Chairman.
But
Representative Schoen, we discussed this before we even did the first bill in my committee, and we agreed that we were going to take that out.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I'm going to support it, but you know what's disappointing is exactly kind of the point I was getting at earlier, was that Representative Hillstrom pointed out that here we have a theft stat. It's a theft. And DNR stated as such, that's the way we treat it. There's a civil penalty that's associated with it. We assign a value. If I'm on Lake Street in Minneapolis and walk out with a Dyson vacuum cleaner, you could go to prison because of the value of that vacuum cleaner. But we have something with maybe a different demographic or who may it be affected by, and now we're not making it a felony when it's got that value. That seems a little suspect, but at least I probably DNR is probably excited just to be moving the needle in a direction they want to go. So,
Mr. Chairman, I just got word that the department has talked to the governor's office and they do support this language.
Okay, with other witnesses.
Mr. Chairman, our other witnesses will forego their testimony if you want to move on. I know it's time is short, but we do have folks here that can testify if you have additional
questions. Sounds like a great idea. You like brevity, just like me. Anybody else have any questions? If not, Chair will renew his motion for House File 2845. Did we amend it? As amended, to be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Next, we have Representative Miller, House File 3370. Okay, Representative, what's that? Oh, yeah. Representative Miller, the chair will move House File 3370 to be referred to civil law and also move the A1 amendment to get it in the bill in the shape the author would like.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, with no objection, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? To your bill, Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This proposal will accomplish three objectives. Number one, it amends statutory language to require any information changes be provided by a predatory offender in writing. My testifier will explain why we need to do that at this time. Number two, it authorizes child protection workers involved in evaluating whether a child can reside with a predatory offender to have access to registration data via the law enforcement agents to whom they are working. And finally, it makes a technical correction related to the previous recodification of civil commitment statute. So without further ado, I ask that my testifier, Drew Evans, the Superintendent of Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, provide testimony to this bill.
Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Drew Evans. I'm the superintendent at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. As Representative Miller noted, I can walk you quickly through the bill. Section 1, the amendment takes care of it. It incorrectly included some references to different civil commitments, so the amendment removes that language. Section 2 is the what we're asking to have done is create the requirement for all updates to be done in writing. What this is in response to is State v. Munger, decided by the Court of Appeals in 2015, found that the statute was not explicit that updates to the predatory offenders changes in primary or secondary addresses, a change in employment, or the motor vehicle used had to be done in writing. This was a long-standing practice of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and our predatory offender registry. That's how we've always required updates to be completed, but the courts found that that requirement was not explicit. Therefore, such changes could be orally done by the offenders, which is problematic for us and creates some issues with the registry. Sections 3 and 4, as noted, the statutes related to the duties related to child protection workers in the state were updated previously, but the reference was not created in our statute to allow us to share information from the registry with the child protection worker who was trying to make a determination whether or not there was a predatory offender residing in the home. And so those changes would allow us to share that, yes, in fact, that person is a registered predatory offender with child protection. And with that, I'll turn it to Representative Miller or any questions the committee may have.
Okay, any questions for Representative Miller or Director Evans, Superintendent, I should say? Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Miller, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. As a deputy sheriff, I used to go around and periodically check on the registered offenders in our community and checking where they lived, where they're supposed to be living, and more than one occasion, where the paperwork said they were supposed to live in, they were not. But because they only did a verbal with their probation officer, not actually filled out the paperwork, they end up getting charged. But the charges end up were dropped. But we had to transport them and book them into the jail. By making the requirement that they have to be signed, that the paperwork will be fulfilled and we know where they're supposed to be.
Thank you. Any other questions? Anybody from the audience to testify? If none, a one-sentence closing statement?
I believe this is a good bill. I appreciate it, Mr. Chair, that you heard it here, and we look forward to moving it forward.
Okay, thank you. The Chair will renew his motion for House File 3370 as amended to be referred to civil law. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you, Representative Miller, and thank you, Superintendent. Representative Scott. Representative Scott, the chair will move your bill, House File 1333, to be referred to the General Registry. And you have an amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I do. I have the A3 amendment.
Okay, the chair will move the A3 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? To your bill, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this bill today. I did receive, and I don't know if it's in your packets, but we did receive word back that there is no fiscal note on this bill. Members, House File 1333 would allow the courts to consider termination or suspension or modification of spousal maintenance if the receiving party is shown to be by the obligor to be cohabitating. In current law, there are three reasons that spousal support can be terminated or reconsidered: death of either the obligee or obligor, remarriage of the obligee, or substantial change in circumstances. Like so much of family law, spousal support or maintenance laws were largely written in the 1970s in a much different era than what we live. I don't think judges could have anticipated the amount of cohabitation that goes on right now. And I think mostly on their radar was the fact that they thought if one of the parties found someone else that they loved, that they would indeed get married. I think it's prudent to take a fresh look at this. And I also want to point out in this bill that no one can make a motion to modify before the divorce decree is in effect until for at least 1 year. This language and the language of the amendment have been approved by the Family Law Section of the Bar and the Minnesotans for Alimony Reform. And I do have a testifier or two here.
Okay, thank you, Representative Scott. You bring your testifier forward, would be great.
We've got one
right there.
Table.
Uh-huh. Sir, if you give your name and organization, go ahead.
Sure, Mr. Chair, honorable committee members, I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you regarding House File 1333. My name is Sid Levin. I live in Chanhassen, Minnesota. Last week, I had the privilege to speak before the Civil Law Committee, and I mentioned there that I pay $3,700 monthly in spousal support to my former wife, even though she's been engaged for nearly 2.5 years. For nearly two of those years, she's lived in his home, and during the 50% of the time that she has my kids, which are four of them, they live in his home as well. They call him stepdad, and he calls them his kids in public, on Facebook and in our synagogue's bulletin. She wears a wedding ring, and so does he, but they have not legally married. Minnesota Statute 518A.39 Subdivision 3 reads, the obligation to pay future maintenance is terminated upon death of either party or the remarriage of the party receiving maintenance. I'm in favor of spousal maintenance as it helps allow the recipient to maintain the lifestyle that he or she has had during the marriage. And furthermore, in the case of a long-term marriage like mine, this can be essential for an ex-spouse to create a foundation for a new life after divorce, perhaps have the opportunity for job training, education, or something else. I'm also in favor of the law that ends that. It was written to end this very obligation if a recipient of maintenance remarried. The law is clear, concise, straightforward, and devoid of conditions. And there, unfortunately, is the problem. As it stands, for those receiving support, the law acts as an incentive to not remarry. In today's world, people live together, they share their lives, they help each other financially, they commit to each other, and even raise families together, all without marriage. Society, for the most part, seems to consider relationships like these not terrifically different than those that have wed. So if you're receiving alimony and society acknowledges your relationship, the question arises, why get married and lose your alimony? Our courts are subject to lawsuits that pertain to these cases, but without the language in the law to address cohabitation, the court all but ignores this issue and remains unwilling and or unable to examine the living situation of a recipient of maintenance and render a decision based upon that. House File 1333 would provide guidance for the court to reduce, suspend, or terminate spousal maintenance based on the factors involved in cohabitation. Moreover, with this guidance, those interested in settlement would have an opportunity with those set of guidelines to help negotiate outside of court. This is a practical common sense update to divorce law that addresses today's world, ends the incentive to behave immorally, and has the opportunity to provide financial closure for divorced couples when they have, when their lives have moved on. I'm grateful for the opportunity to be heard by your committee. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Did you have any other testifiers?
There are a couple of other folks that are on the agenda. Okay. Jill Kosh-Anderson.
If we could keep it short, I think we got about six or seven more bills before noon. Go ahead, ma'am.
Mr. Chair and committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Jill Kosh-Anderson, and I live in Prior Lake, Minnesota. I met my husband 4 years ago, and we both have been divorced for about 3 years at that time. I did not receive spousal maintenance from my divorce, nor did I want to. My husband's divorce started in 2009, and on average, he has been in and out of court four times every year over the past 7 years. The reason? His ex keeps asking for more maintenance. He was ordered to pay her $1,100 a month on a $50,000 a year salary. He is a concrete finisher, and with that said, it's a seasonal job, and he does get laid off during the winter months. Receiving permanent spousal maintenance does not prepare the ex-spouse to be able to take care of themselves, or does it promote marriage? We were married in December of 2015, and she already filed a motion to ask for more money. The court honored her more money just last week, using my income, stating that we would now be able to afford to pay her more money. If I would have known this, I would not have married my husband. Now, since we did the right thing, we are being punished. His ex moved in with her boyfriend 5 years ago and has admitted she has no financial responsibilities, yet they will not get married as the alimony payments would end. With the law the way it is written now, it is anti-marriage, and it is discouraging people from getting married. With the new law in place, it will give the payer finality, the courts and judges guidelines when it comes to cohabitation, and will put a stop to the ongoing litigation, saving costs across the board for everyone. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
There's one final testifier, Tim Dennis.
Sir, if you've got a very long statement, maybe you could just tell us in your own words. We're kind of short of time. So.
I'll do the best I can. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. How can I even make this brief? Well, my ex-wife has been living with her domestic partner for 10 years now. In 2007, I asked the court to terminate permanent spousal maintenance. I had evidence that he's living at her address. He signed an affidavit, and that he received his mail there. At that time, the court refused to consider it, stating that there was no law addressing cohabitation. It's been 10 years now, and they are fully committed. I don't see that they'll ever marry. Why would they? I will have to go back to court again to suspend maintenance when I have surgery on my knees and shoulder, and again to see if I can retire. If House File 1333 had been in effect in 2007, I believe it would have addressed my ex-cohabitation and ended the spousal maintenance, avoiding the cost of returning to court. Adding cohabitation language to Minnesota law, allowing the court to modify spousal maintenance, could save money. In my case, not having returned to the court multiple times and once the law, it should not greatly impact the court calendars or costs, as current obligors could, one, accept the law ending maintenance and get married, two, accept and agree it now ends due to cohabitation, or three, accept the law, realize the cost of litigation, and they could stipulate a lump sum agreement to terminate the spousal maintenance for less than the cost to litigate. I understand there's a time and place for spousal maintenance. It is unfortunate that so many have learned how to abuse the system and to extort their former spouse. There are countless stories like mine, and worse, others who have made their payments and didn't run away, who have paid their support until their ex-spouse found happiness and support with someone again. We are asking you to support marriage in Minnesota, the marriages that the obligees are choosing to forego. Please add cohabitation language to Minnesota law by voting in favor of House File 1333. Thank you for hearing my testimony.
Thank you, sir. All right, thank you, Representative Scott. Any questions for the Representative Scott's bill? Okay, seeing none, the chair will move House File 1333 to be referred to the General Register as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Representative Scott.
Thank you.
Sorry to hurry you through with this.
No worries.
Okay. Representative Pinto, House File 2976. Representative Pinto, I'll move your bill, House File, unless one of you folks would like to move your colleague's bill.
What is it first?
I'll move it.
It's a good bill.
Attempting to hire a minor for prostitution, yeah. Penalties increased. All right, Representative Schoen, move House File 2976 to be referred to
the
General Register. Do you have any amendments?
No amendments.
No amendments. Okay, sure. Representative Pinto, go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. under current state law, buying sex from a minor is a felony, and the sentence increases as the age of the victim decreases. For example, buying sex with a 12-year-old results in a higher sentence than buying sex with a 17-year-old. Until last year, the crime had to involve an actual minor. There could not be an undercover officer involved. Representative Quam had a bill that fixed that problem so that now an undercover officer can be used. But unfortunately, there was an important point that was missed, which was that the change in sentence, so the sentence increases as the age of the victim decreases, that got omitted from the bill. So this simply adds that escalation of sentence as the age of the victim drops, simply added that to the bill. So this way, the penalty for buying sex from a minor of a given age would be the same whether there's an actual minor involved at that age or whether, in fact, an undercover officer is used, and then there's not a need to have an actual child involved, which, of course, is the best way to do this. So, Mr. Chair, I have a testifier here on the bill.
Sir, if your name and organization, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sergeant Grant Snader. I'm the lead detective with the Minneapolis Police Department. I'm the one that created the Guardian Angels operation that we've been doing for about the past 2 years in the state of Minnesota. With regard to this particular law, I provided testimony last year when we repaired 609324 so that it would reflect the language appropriate to include an undercover officer acting in the capacity, posing as an underage girl. That's me, by all intents and purposes. I'm the one out there posing as a 15-year-old girl. I apologize for the creepy visual you guys have to live with for the rest of the day. And you can imagine their surprise when they meet me at the door. But what's important about this is that in the process of doing this for the past 2 years, we've arrested somewhere upwards of 135 men. This year alone, we're on track to arrest over 250 because we've increased the number of operations that we're doing them statewide, so that if we post an ad on Backpage, and that ad runs for a period of several minutes, we probably will receive within about 10 minutes about 40 responses to that ad. Over the course of a day, we'll probably communicate with somewhere between 100 and 150 men. Of that, somewhere around 12% will actually show up at the door knowing that they're going to have sex with an underage girl. It's very important to recognize that the demographic, as that age drops, that demographic changes as well. There is a fundamental difference between an offender who's willing to show up and have sex with a 12-year-old and a person that's willing to show up and have sex with a 15 or 17-year-old. What I'm proposing here in support of Representative Pinto's legislation is simply that the law reflect the realities of who those offenders are and make sure that the penalties are appropriately condition to reflect that reality as well.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Any questions from the group here? Okay, any closing statement, Representative Pinto?
Mr. Chair, thank you for your support, members of the committee as well. Appreciate it.
Okay, good bill, Representative Pinto. House File 2976, Chair will move to refer to the General Register. Representative Schoen, you were the original motion maker. You want to move the bill?
Yep.
Okay, Representative Schoen, 2976 to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Hey, Mr. Chair.
Hey, thank you. Members. Representative Howe. And you may move your own bill to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to move House File, and I don't even know, 2554 to the General Register.
Okay, Representative Howe's bill before us, 2554. Go ahead, Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members might remember this from the omnibus bill, the public safety omnibus bill last year. It was amendment to the omnibus bill on the House floor. Basically, what it does is it changes who we're going to include on this. What caused this to come about was the the incident in Wilmer where we had a person that didn't impersonate a commissioned officer, but impersonated a non-commissioned officer as a sergeant major, which I think would be much more of an offense than impersonating a lieutenant, but so be it. They chose not to file any charges on the member. And the concern here is if we have a state active duty mission, someone could come in, impersonate an NCO or an enlisted person, and actually have all the enforcement, because people don't know any better. You see someone in a uniform, you see someone in uniform, and they could be preventing people from getting to their homes or telling people they had to leave, evacuate from their homes. That's why the Department of Military Affairs supports the bill. I talked to the executive director, Don Kerr. We would have heard the bill earlier, he would have been here to testify, but he had to step away and won't be here to testify. But that's the bill, Mr. Chair, and I'll stand for any questions.
Any questions from members? Yeah, I heard this bill in another committee, and it looked like a pretty good bill, non-controversial. With no questions, the chair will move House File 2554 be referred. Oh, no, you can move your own. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. That's my motion.
Okay. Representative Howell moves 2554 to be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Thank you, Representative Howell. Representative Zerwas, House File 2344. Representative Zerwas, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, House File 2344 is another licensure bill out of the licensure subcommittee.
Go ahead and move your bill.
Oh, I will move House File 2344 be referred to HHS Finance.
Okay, Representative Zerwas, go ahead.
House File 2344 is another bill from the licensure subcommittee. It's a licensure bill for orthotics and prosthetics, dealing with folks that fit artificial limbs and braces, what can oftentimes be $250,000 upwards on some of the new artificial limbs, pieces of medical equipment that, if not fitted appropriately and not done per individual patient, could quite honestly and sadly turn into a six-figure paperweight that the individual cannot utilize to meet their basic needs of mobility and participate in their life. We are here today, like the other licensure bills, only because this bill does create a misdemeanor if you practice without a license in the state.
Representative Schoen, Representative Schoen, could I do the amendment first so we get the bill that we're talking about in front of us? Representative Zerwas would like to move his DE1 amendment. Without objection, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Representative Schoen.
So I was hoping that this might help because it looks like Representative Zerwas was going the direction I was going. The reason it's here, I mean, we're going to hear this in Health Finance, but it's simply the penalty.
Yeah.
And so is that penalty any different than any other licensure, or is it on par? I mean, basically what I saw was a licensure penalty that fit the guidelines. We're not doing anything drastically different, and I would support. I'm throwing out there my support without having to go into detail about the health care portion of this bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, yes, we're here just for the criminal penalty of practicing without a license.
Okay. Oh, did you have a testifier?
I was just here for questions. My name is Ruth Grendel. I'm the executive director of the Board of Podiatric Medicine and Dietetics and Nutrition Practice. And to answer your question, on podiatric medicine side, it is a gross misdemeanor to be practicing without a license. And on dietetics and nutrition practice, it's a misdemeanor. But we also have a $10,000 civil penalty that's involved on the dietetic side. So it's pretty similar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Zerwas. My question relates to licensure generally applies to an individual, and I'm assuming that that individual may oversee other individuals who may not be licensed in the creation of these particular prosthetics and things like that. So this applies at some point along the line. There needs to be an individual that's licensed involved in the process. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, this deals with the actual license holder, orthetician or orthotist, who could then, if not actually licensed, but misrepresents that, would be guilty of the misdemeanor. There are some that participate in the fabrication that would not be licensed and are clearly defined within the language here. And this, anyone that's doing this practice and can bill underneath CMS right now meets the accreditation certification requirements in the bill that's required for licensure.
Okay, Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zerwas. Under orthotics, say my chiropractor fits me with a pair of orthotics and it's currently not licensed. So under this bill, are they held liable or are they, what goes on with them?
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair, members, there was some comfort language with some of our durable medical equipment folks so that things like shoes, insoles, diabetic shoe, that type of stuff is not, we're talking about very sophisticated, individually made braces for legs, arms, for the torso. We're talking about cranial skull caps. We're talking about what can very quickly become $100,000, $140,000, $180,000artificial limbs. So insoles and that type of stuff, we have comfort language here with our durable medical equipment suppliers that this bill does not impact their operations.
Okay, if there's no other questions, Representative Zerwas, I'm always impressed how well you know your own bills. You can answer your own questions. So, you want to move
Mr.
your
Chair.
Bill?
With that, I'll renew my motion, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Zerwas removes his motion to send House File 2344 to Health and Human Services Finance as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Chair will do the bill from the chair. I'll move House File 3590 to be referred to the General Register. Members, got an amendment?
Yeah.
And the chair will also move the amendment, the DE1 amendment, to get in the shape I'd like it. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Members, especially Representative Dean, will love this bill here. We actually make it easier for somebody to get off of a probation here. This bill creates an earned compliance credit, a program that may reduce an offender's probation or supervised release period. If the offender fulfills a plan, has no new arrests, complies with treatment, and makes scheduled payments for restitution, child support, and fines. And members, this came out of the, I think Senator Latz has the counterpart, and it came out of the Prison Population Task Force over the interim here, and one of the ideas that came out. And Mr. Erdman, would you please proceed?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Ryan Erdman, Executive Director at the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties. I'll be very brief. We support the bill, particularly in its amended form. We've long supported the concept of this earned compliance credit. We were involved in some legislation that created over 7 years ago that created a model policy for this. However, even with all those years passed, I would say we're not really ready for implementation in Minnesota. That's why we support the amended version. We'll work very closely with the DOC on putting something together that we can't implement, but again, a study and getting some a backbone behind how we could implement this is a great idea. We'd love to learn more and are happy to be part of the process. So that's all I'll say for now unless there are questions. Thank you very much.
Members, any questions? If not, the chair will move House File 3590 as amended to go to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, members, just an announcement. We're kind of tracking down bills with fiscal notes if they come up after and sending them to Ways and Means or recalling, and that whatever we have to do, Representative Hillsmith wanted to let you know that. So.
Thank you.
Okay, if no questions, meeting adjourned.